Good evening, and welcome to the Mutual Fund Observer conversation with Andrew Foster of the Seafarer Funds conference call. All participants will be in listen-only mode. Should you need assistance, please signal a conference specialist by pressing the star key followed by zero. After today's presentation, there will be an opportunity to ask questions. To ask a question, you may press star, then one on your touchtone phone. To withdraw your question, please press star, then two. Please note, this event is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to David Snowball. Please go ahead.
Great. Thank you, Pedro. Welcome to the Mutual Fund Observer's conversation with Andrew Foster. Andrew is president of Seafarer Funds and portfolio manager of Seafarer Overseas Growth and Income. By way of background, Chuck Jaffe highlighted some intriguing and counterintuitive research from the folks at Athena Invest. Their research suggests that most equity fund managers actually are able to do a better job of assembling a portfolio than you imagine. In particular, by Athena's calculation, about 90% of all active managers outperform their benchmarks, or would, except for a couple nagging factors. The most obvious are expenses of operating the fund, but even allowing for those expenses, about 80% of managers have the skills to outperform their benchmarks. But of course, they don't because of a series of self-inflicted injuries that the study's authors refer to as the portfolio tax. The tax is the drag imposed by three decisions. They become too big, they trade too often, and they seek shelter in the herd. Collectively, those decisions sabotage the vast majority of all managers. The Observer tries to find the others. We cover primarily the universe of funds that are off Morningstar's radar. We write for intellectually curious, serious investors who need to go beyond marketing fluff and computer-generated recommendations. We try to help you identify funds that matter. We think that describes Seafarer, just as it has described the other funds that Andrew's managed over a distinguished career. Our plan is to devote the first third of our hour together to an introduction to the fund, the middle third to my conversation with Andrew, and the final third to your questions. As we approach that moment, Pedro will remind you of what it takes to get in the queue. So, Andrew, thanks for joining us, and congratulations on your well-deserved recognition for Morningstar.
Thank you, David. Thank you for inviting me to be here today, and thanks for arranging this call. And I would also just say thank you for all the efforts you do with respect to Mutual Fund Observer. I know that we are very appreciative, and I'm sure that your audience is very appreciative as well.
Do you want to talk to us a bit about Seafarer?
Sure. Seafarer has been around for about 4 years now. We have one U.S. mutual fund in registration. The fund itself is a little over 3 years at present, and it's a global emerging market fund. As of today, it has about $160 million in assets under management, and we're really excited to be managing it. This is an exciting business for us to be engaged in, and an exciting investment opportunity for us to pursue over the long term. We really enjoy the work we do, so it gives us a great deal of energy and excitement to come into work every day. It's something we love to do.
Cool. Do you want to talk about the approach you take with the fund, Andrew, or how would you like to proceed for your chunk here?
Yeah, sure. So, David, I'll take maybe about 10 or 15 minutes here to talk a little bit about the strategy of the fund. It's called the Seafarer Overseas Growth and Income Fund. What it does in pursuing growth in the emerging markets, I think probably one important thing to underscore from the get-go is it's a relative return strategy. That is to say, we're trying to pursue the growth of the emerging world or the developing world, and In so much as we do that, our primary equity benchmark is the MSCI Emerging Markets Index. And I think over long periods of time, that index will more or less reflect the growth of the emerging world with some important caveats. And our goal is to try and hopefully outperform it slowly but steadily over time. The strategy tries to pursue growth from the emerging markets that's a bit more sustainable. We try to be value conscious in pursuing that sustainable growth, but it is at the core a relative return portfolio relative to the performance of that index that we try and improve upon. We search for sustainable growth, and as we do so, we try and marry it with some current income. It's an important part of the strategy in that income acts as a key tool to understanding the quality of the growth that we're finding, as well as the valuation of that growth. So really what we do is we look for companies that can pay dividends or other forms of current income, sometimes coupons on bonds or dividends on preferred equities. And what we do is the dividend does three things for us as we look for sustainable growth. Actually, before I talk about dividends, let me talk about what sustainable growth is first, because it's quite important in the current context. We've come through a period in the emerging world recently where the growth has been not negative or zero, but extremely weak and anemic over the last 3 years, the 3 years that more or less coincide with CFAIR's launch. And what we try and do, and one of the problems with that anemic growth is people had fairly high estimations for that growth 3 years ago. It's maybe hard to remember that at this moment in time, but I've got data that suggests that people were actually expecting very substantial rates of growth back in 2011 and 2012 from the emerging world. And that growth failed to materialize. And arguably, people were perhaps overpaying for that growth. When I say people, I mean the broader market space. Investors in general, they were overpaying for growth that didn't actually materialize in the end, in actuality. Our strategy tries to find a relatively sustainable strain of that growth within the overall broader market. We typically look for companies that can compound revenue growth steadily over long periods of time. If you wanted to put a quantitative measure on that, we look for companies that can grow maybe between 7 and 15% in revenue terms, in nominal terms, for long periods of time. We pay attention to bottom line earnings growth, but we're much more forgiving about that being a company not growing over the short run in terms of earnings or cash flow, because a lot of things can impact a 1 or 2 or 3 year view. So we're looking for companies that can produce that steady top line growth, because we think that if the top line's growing, eventually the bottom line will follow, the profits of the company. Mm-hmm. And I think that sustainability is really what we try and capture in the portfolio. And we don't necessarily try and chase the fastest growth in the market. In this case, we were really sort of fortunate, I guess you could say, or lucky that our strategy was well suited for an environment where growth was relatively anemic, because we were searching for and seemed to have found a more sustainable strain of it. I would say that we look for dividends alongside that growth, and it's an important part of the strategy, but I want to stress dividends don't do anything magical. They are really a means to an end in terms of vetting the quality and valuation of the growth that we've hopefully found. Dividends do three things for the strategy. First, they do act as an essential, albeit crude, valuation tool. What we do, we use a lot of things to value the stocks in which we invest, and we use some typical discounted cash flow models, which I realize that's jargon, but a lot of people use a certain kind of a mm-hmm. model to value a company's future cash flow and try and relate that to the current stock price. We use such models, but we also use a model that just looks at what's called the free cash flow yield. And it's basically the cash flow of the company divided by the current stock price. That doesn't have any mechanism for discounting the cash flow to the present, like a discounted cash flow model might, because models that are the typical DCF model, as it's known, is very complicated to apply across borders, not least because the discount rates in such models are difficult to utilize across borders, and so too are the accounting standards. So we actually favor a very simple and crude model that looks at how free cash flow at a company is changing over time, and how it might be growing, and what component of that might be paid out to shareholders. So this is a very basic but standard model that we it's really the only one that we can apply universally across the portfolio without making lots of adjustments. The second thing income does, I think there's strong empirical evidence around this. Theoretically, it's a little harder to say why it's the case, but the data bears it out. A portfolio that has an emphasis on current yield, stable, somewhat higher than average yield, dividend yield, if you will, tends to be less rocky and tends to fall less rapidly in an adverse set of market conditions than a portfolio that doesn't have such an emphasis, say a neutral portfolio. Mm-hmm. I want to stress that just going for high dividend yield doesn't necessarily make the difference, because high dividend yields can often imply some distress that the market perceives that the company won't be able to maintain the dividend of the past. So the key is getting sort of a sweet spot where you're a little higher than average, but not so high that you're picking up a lot of distress in your portfolio. And in that sort of event, your portfolio tends to be a little less rocky. It doesn't do anything magical. It doesn't stop a portfolio from falling in a downward market. Mm-hmm. It just tends to fall a little less rapidly and maybe finds a floor underneath it a little sooner than the market as a whole. So it does help to protect a bit on the downside. The last thing that dividends do that's the most important to me personally is they act as a key and underappreciated signal for the liquidity and solvency of a company in the emerging world. So I think I was asked on our prior call 2 years ago, which we were so grateful to attend then and to have this follow-up now, about what an emerging market is or how do you define it. There are a lot of different definitions. One that I'm increasingly using is a market where you have a set of cruddy or poorly developed capital markets. That is bond markets, banking systems, stock markets. Without judging our own markets here in the United States and how volatile they've been, I will say they are more liquid, deep, transparent, and better regulated, believe it or not, than most other markets the world over. We have our fair share of problems, but everything I've said is still true.
Right.
And the emerging world is constantly beset by liquidity and credit shocks. In fact, so much so that I'm beginning to think it's synonymous with one of the conditions for what it means to be an emerging market. And the problem that means is that what that means is companies don't survive those shocks to the same extent as people imagine. People forecast high rates of growth that if everything was to go along swimmingly, those companies might actually realize. But the problem is liquidity and credit crunches eventually unfold, and they're quite severe, even more severe than developed markets. And companies either collapse under the strain, or they don't collapse, but they completely fail and fall short of the kind of growth forecasts that were made for them that sort of justified the original investment. And they end up drowning under either too much debt or too much inability to raise funds at a critical moment. So if we were to get really theoretical here for a minute, there's a set of theoreticians, I think in the 50s or 60s, very famous, mm-hmm. called Miller and Modigliani. They basically prove mathematically that dividends don't matter to a company's value. And mathematically, I can't really argue with that theory. Practically speaking, though, I can argue with one of the premises behind their theory, which is that companies have basically unfettered access to capital at a price when they need it. That doesn't mean they get it for free, but they can get it, and they can get it at a fair price, a rational price. And that's not what happens in the emerging world. Companies literally fail because they can't get it. So a dividend basically tells you a company is liquid and solvent enough to transform a portion of its earnings into something it can pay out to its shareholders. And that makes a world of difference in terms of signaling the quality of the accounts as well as the underlying liquidity and solvency of the business and its business model. So you may have a fast-growing company that doesn't pay dividends, and it may be a great company, but you don't really know demonstrably whether or not, if it's liquid and solvent, if it can't pay a mm-hmm. dividend or won't pay a dividend. And surely if you assemble a basket of companies that are dividend non-dividend payers and compare it to a basket of companies that are dividend payers, the dividend payers are certainly at a basket level going to be much more liquid and solvent. And that's, I think, one of the small inefficiencies in the emerging markets that we seek to exploit over time. We are bottom up is another in terms of our strategy. That's another key aspect of it. That means we look at individual companies on their own unique merits rather than making big sweeping country or sector level decisions. It's very important we do this, and it's really a matter of trying to know what we know and know what we don't know. I think one of the things that is really confusing is that if you look at what causes the dispersion in returns from an international fund or an emerging market fund in hindsight, like over a 5 or 10 year horizon. And by dispersion or returns, I mean the kind of the variance in outcomes. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. You would easily and rightly say that a good, 70 or 80% of the returns were driven by what people call macro or top-down factors, country issues, political issues, interest rate issues, currency issues, sector effects. And so in trying to explain the variance, you would rightly pin it on these macro effects. The problem is I personally believe the vast majority of those factors are unforecastable. And the only thing you can do to insulate yourself from the risks that those factors present is diversify and to hold your portfolio for a long period of time during which most of those fairly pronounced macro factors will begin to cancel each other out. And what you can do, I think, as an active manager, is begin to digest some of the micro factors about individual companies that impact the other 20 to maybe 30% of the variance in outcomes. And you can, it's difficult, but you can, through careful study from the bottom up, as it were, start to look at companies and analyze them and make discrete decisions that can impact long-term outcomes. So what I would say is it's not that we don't care about the macro, it's just more that we say we can't predict it. Mm-hmm. The one thing we do is we look at how the macro impacts our companies. If we're worried about a macro issue, something going on in a particular country or what have you, we ask, what does it mean for this company? That's the other thing. I think there's another advantage about looking at things from the bottom up, which is when you look at these macro factors, they are so hard to comprehend in their complexity. And, you might build a model to try and figure some of these things out about how, interest rates are impacting China or liquidity conditions or what have you. But for everything you figure out, there are 20 other things you haven't even bothered to specify in your model that might affect the outcome. But when you start to look at those factors as how they might impact an individual company, you at least have a framework that is difficult to assess, but it can be addressed with some basic understanding. So that's really why we look at the bottom up. We pay attention to fundamentals. We're very much focused on cash flow as opposed to accounting earnings. Accounting earnings can sometimes matter, but especially a company's ability to grow its liquidity, solvency, and cash flow over time is a critical issue. We look at how cash flow waterfalls through a capital structure. So we do what I mean by that is we don't only buy stocks. We sometimes buy other instruments that companies issue. So we start by looking at issuers first, and then we sometimes buy things other than the common stock if we think there's some preference to owning those other instruments in lieu of the stock. So we don't go into a company's bonds unless we understand the company's equity and have decided that the bonds or convertible bonds or preferred stock give us some preference vis-a-vis the equity. But we start from a perspective of being a bottom-up equity researcher and then sometimes not too often, but sometimes move higher up the capital structure. I think there are, I've just sat there and kind of told you that we're really bottom-up in orientation. There are, I would guess, sort of two things we do that are a little more macro-oriented in terms of the big picture. We do spend a lot of time, we don't spend a lot of time trying to figure out which countries are going to grow faster than others or what have you. That we think is very difficult to forecast, particularly over shorter horizons, not really impossible. What we do do is spend a lot of time analyzing our benchmark against which we are judged. And we do seek to add value by picking individual stocks versus the market, but we also think there is a disconnect between the benchmark and the market itself, where the benchmark doesn't always represent soundly the nature of the underlying market. So more than your audience might believe, I'm actually a fan of passive investments. I think passive investment can be a very good thing to do, provided you have three conditions. One, you know, you want to keep costs low. That's a very important thing, active or passive. You want to keep churn low. That's also very important, active or passive. But the one thing about passive that people sort of take for granted, take as almost assumed, is that the benchmark, the index that your passive strategy uses, that the benchmark index itself is soundly constructed and represents the underlying market fairly or without many filters. And I think there's reasons to believe that the benchmark that we are judged by doesn't do that terribly well. I would just kind of give you a few data points to contemplate. The core of the reason for this, by the way, is that the benchmark, by design, has some filters put on its sampling of the underlying market space. Instead of going out and weighting each company according to its market capitalization, as most U.S. benchmarks do or developed benchmarks do, it has two filters put on it. It has a filter called replicability and one called scalability. But these are basically different sides of the same coin. They're basically saying, is the position liquid enough and easy enough to replicate for a foreign investor to scale it up quickly? They want to build a benchmark that can be easily replicated without fuss or muss. And that's very understandable. It is not what classic indexing is about, though. And the consequence of this liquidity filter can be quite eye-popping. And I'll give you one key statistic that we spend a lot of time thinking about, is that the emerging world right now has about $14 trillion in capitalization. The index only covers, there's an MSCI core index and there's an MSCI total market index. The core index is a little narrower. It covers about $3.8 trillion in capitalization, and the total index, $4.2
trillion.
So there's a heck of a lot of capitalization out there that the index doesn't even touch. If you take $3.8 trillion divided by 14, it's about a little over 25%. The equivalent statistic for the United States is 80%. So the index picks up a lot more of the capitalization, and you get a more natural representation of how the world really is. So the benchmark leaves a lot of territory undiscovered. And so I think one of the interesting things is to figure out where the benchmark may not, you know, what valuable parts of the market is the benchmark not paying attention to because of these liquidity filters. And that sometimes prioritizes where we go hunting for our bottom-up ideas. And it also prioritizes a little bit how we might weight them having found them.
Okay.
The last thing I would just say is we try and be long-term in our orientation. We really, you know, we don't do things. It's so hard because everyone wants to know where are things going this year, and we just, I don't know. I will speculate, but my speculations aren't really, you know, worth a dime, much less a penny. So we try and do things on a horizon that's at least three years. I mean, I don't even think about something unless it's at least 3 years in horizon. But really, we're trying to aim for 5 years, 10 years, or even really when what the ultimate mark of something we like to do is own something forever. The only thing that we're a little, Buffett often talks about owning something forever. We're a little different because he has a very different vehicle that he runs. He doesn't have an open-ended mutual fund where people can sell everything tomorrow if they don't like what's going on. His money is sort of captive and sits with him. So we talk about owning things over an indefinite horizon. We might own it forever. We might be forced to sell it tomorrow because people ask for their money back. It's a different kind of way of thinking about the horizon of your investment. But we do really try and push out the horizon as long as possible. The last thing I'm going to say, and I'll turn it back over to you, is that we are so proud of our performance over the last few years, and I think some of your callers today have looked at our performance. I would stress that we, as proud as we are about this performance, as I said at the outset, we have really benefited from the fact that our strategy was uniquely well positioned in an environment where growth was disappointing and anemic. We were looking for sustainable growth. I would say arguably or perhaps demonstrably we found it, but the index did not, and it let people down performance-wise. But I would say that at the margin, here's where I'm getting into speculation, and I really don't know what I'm talking about, but I would say that there are signs for the first time in years that the deceleration of growth in the emerging world is perhaps over. Growth is not picking up necessarily to any great extent, but it's at least stabilizing and maybe picking up just a little bit. And that's well different from the last 3 years where growth has been on a the rate of growth has been on a steady downward trajectory and fallen well below people's expectation. So in an environment where growth is picking up and where investors domestically and overseas might start to pay attention to that change and even pay up for it or chase it even in terms of valuation, right, our strategy is not going to do as well. In fact, it may do not well at all compared to the index, because we're looking for, still going to keep looking for that sustainable strain of growth, and we're going to be cognizant about what we pay for it. And the way I look at it is that the major source of return from our fund over 10 years will be what people call beta. Beta is basically capturing the rate of growth available from equities from the index. It's basically what part of your performance comes from the broader market. And some people call alpha the part of value that active management can add in addition to that. We have, I said at the outset, we imagine ourselves as a relative return strategy where we're primarily here to harness beta in a way that is less volatile, more sustainable. We hope, if we do our jobs well, that we might add a bit of alpha. I don't know, maybe if we're lucky, 2 percentage points of alpha over very long horizons. I think we'd be lucky to do that. And the index will maybe produce a higher rate of return than that, maybe 7 to 9% over very long horizons. I don't know those numbers. I can't prove those numbers, but I'm just trying to give you an order of magnitude that the alpha we seek to produce is a fraction of the beta we seek to harness. And we have had a lot of quote-unquote alpha over the last 3 years, and in a certain sense, we've captured a lot of our alpha early. And as things change, I wouldn't expect us to capture as much alpha going forward. If anything, we may lose some alpha as the beta picks up.
Okay.
That's it.
That's the goal. It's one of, I think I described it somewhere as a win by not losing sort of approach to sort of managing stocks. I thought what I would do, if the folks listening in could be patient for a couple minutes, I thought we could go through 3 or 4 sort of big picture things, and then we can check in with Pedro to see if there are folks who would like to speak to you directly. And so here's at the big picture level, we normally think of Seafarer as an equity fund or as a stock fund. Traditionally, though, you're about 80% equity, about 20% then between preferred shares and warrants and bonds and that sort of thing. Is there much of a different art or much of a different challenge in picking the non-equity part of the portfolio? Or is it merely once you find a really good company, you just see how far up the food chain you can go?
It's more the latter. I think, I hope I don't sound too disingenuous, but I really don't. I think these are all security. Even in our very modern, sophisticated financial markets, I think there's way too much attention given to whether something is an equity or a bond. Now, obviously, there are hugely different characteristics to bonds versus equity. Bonds have certain legal rights, certain rights in liquidation, certain preferential rights. But the reason why I'm saying that they're not as different as they might appear is because they're all cash flows that emanate from an issuer, and they're all bundled up in different ways with different levels of seniority. They're not somehow completely different animals. They're cousins. And understanding the trade-offs between the two is, I think you first have to look at the health of the entity from which they're issued. That's what I meant by the fact that we go and look at a bottom-up issuer, and we don't buy bonds from issuers we don't think are healthy in the first place, because being higher up the food chain doesn't help you if the issuer is structurally unhealthy. It might help you a little bit, but it doesn't help you a lot. At least in the emerging world, it doesn't. Maybe it's a little different in a developed market. And so what we often find is if we go, quote-unquote, higher up the food chain, up higher up the capital structure, we sometimes find instruments trading with odd valuations that seem dislocated. The instrument may be much safer than equity, but priced similarly, or it might be trading at a deep discount to equity despite not having major differences from equity. Or it might offer certain protections that equity doesn't offer, that while the instrument enjoys a higher valuation than equity, it doesn't seem to even remotely capture how much more risk preference or protection the instrument affords. So convertibles can often be attractive for a company that where the underlying health of the issuer is fine, but there are some riskier outcomes associated with the equity that you can avoid. Mm-hmm. By being in the convertible, and the convertible is not terribly more expensive, and things work out for the company, you're still going to do very well in the convertible. It's a fairly simplistic framework in that regard, but it's really about understanding the health of the issuer and what likely outcomes might happen, and trying to pick a point that might be a little better than other points in the capital structure, versus saying there's a big distinction between stocks and bonds. There is a distinction, but it's not as big as people imagine.
Right. Right. And I mean, given that you're at 80% stock, there appears to be some sort of systemic value added to equity, right? I mean, it's not that they're interchangeable in your mind.
They're not. And there's, we're at a point in history where I think, without me getting into a big argument over where bonds are globally in terms of valuation, I would just say that we've gone through a very anemic period of growth in the emerging world where people have kind of gotten sick and tired of hearing about the EM growth story, the emerging market growth story, and failing to deliver. And so people are kind of sort of not as interested in owning equities, frankly. And it just means that there's maybe on a risk preference basis a little more, I think, attraction to us at least in investing in equities to try and capture that growth, and maybe a little over preference by the market in owning more sure cash flow streams vis-a-vis bonds. And so that we're willing to take that risk that growth is not as bad as it seems and might even be stabilizing. And so we're happy to own a bit more equity. So it is, I would say it's a little harder to find good values in the bond land. I don't think I would surprise anyone saying that globally. And the same is true for the emerging markets.
So you talked about insulating your shareholders and with a couple strategies. One of them is diversifying. And some of the folks on the board were curious because you hold 35 to 40 equity positions. And they were trying to figure out if that was a matter of structural necessity. There are only 35 or 40 good ideas out there, or there are only 35 to 40 that you could pay attention to, institutional, or you just think that's the amount of diversification that you need to capture the balance you're looking for?
It's answers 2 and 3.
Okay.
Both. I think over t- I've been doing this for I've been in this industry for I guess almost 17 years. One of the lessons I haven't been in it quite 17 years because I took a few years off to go to school, but I started 17 years ago, and one of the lessons I've definitely taken away from that time is that if you're going to be an active manager, you've got to A, be different from the index, and B, know your companies well enough that you can. The single most important decision you make is whether or not to admit or delete something from the portfolio. But a heck of a lot of value can also be created if you know an issuer and a stock well enough to add to it when the chips are down. And the longer the longer your list of your names are in your portfolio, the less well you know it, almost by definition. I would even say, even if you have a very large team that aids you in that exercise, you still have to integrate that information into timely decision making that's well informed and free of biases. So even if you have 100 analysts reporting to you on 100 stocks, imagine integrating those 100 viewpoints into a cohesive whole. It's hard to do.
Right.
So I think for me, the sweet spot I've sort of morphed towards is 40 to 60 stocks or securities. I do think that I tolerate as much diversification as necessary to the last point you said was, I said answers two and three, so I'm basically endorsing point two. To endorse point three, I try not to have any more diversification than is necessary, because again, I need enough diversification to protect against different outcomes that I can't predict, the macro stuff that I alluded to earlier in the call.
Right.
There are times where I'm more confident about our ability to control those risks and more confident about the outlook for markets. And in those instances, I will tend to brook less diversification. And conversely, when markets are maybe more richly valued and the outcome, the potential range of outcomes is less clear, there's a wider variety of outcomes, I would tend to insulate against that that wider spread of unknown possibilities with a few more issuers, possibly as many as 60. So it's really a function of those two things.
Okay. Pedro, I was going to ask Andrew one more question and then turn the lines over to our listeners. Do you want to remind folks of what it would take to ask a question?
Sure thing. To ask a question, you may do so by pressing star, then one on your touchtone phone. If you're using a speakerphone, please pick up your handset before pressing the keys. To withdraw your question, please press star, then two. Those would be the instructions to ask a question.
Great. One of the things that you said is that sort of a defining characteristic of the emerging markets is that their capital markets are poorly developed and somewhat inefficient. And a number of the folks on our discussion board wanted to go and ask about markets that went below poorly developed to, I would imagine, you know, occasionally disastrous. In their development, and those are the frontier markets. The folks were wondering if you spent much time looking at those smaller and woolier markets. They noted that you did at one point have some exposure to Vietnam through an ETF, but they didn't know where it kind of fell in Seafarer's future.
Yeah, we still have exposure to Vietnam. We got our license to invest there directly, and I would say have generally had good experience in Vietnam to date, and it remains a part of the portfolio. Whether or not we have tried to have a broader definition of what an emerging market is, and we haven't wanted to be beholden to any particular index maker's list of countries, as it were. We wanted to be able to admit countries to our list or possibly delete countries over time as they, I suppose some could emerge and become quote-unquote fully developed. And so we have wanted to explore the idea of looking at frontier markets over time, but I would also confess very quickly, it's not a major part of what we do and nor will it be. And most of it is because most of these markets lack two things. They lack enough on-the-ground safety for me to send my team there to validate the financials of these companies and validate the nature of these companies. That's true for some of these quote-unquote frontier markets. I shouldn't say for all. And then for others, it's really a function of the development of their capital markets. There's just simply not big or liquid enough for me to be comfortable. If I was running a private fund where I didn't have liquidity, sort of on-demand daily mm-hmm. liquidity constraints, I would definitely consider looking at these frontier markets more, but at least consider it. But I think I'm generally looking for sufficient liquidity around the currency to move in and out of the country, as well as with the stock markets in those countries. They need to basically offer some bigger, more liquid and traded issues. And a lot of these frontier markets just don't have that. It's very narrow. There might be one or two somewhat bigger stocks, but it's really very narrow. Now, I have spent a little bit of time looking at some of what are known as the frontier markets, and I think you'll see, if you pay attention to CFAIR for the next 10 years, I think you will see us move into various markets over that kind of time frame. But in the short run, it's not a big part of what we do.
Cool. That seems fair. Pedro, the folks who had a question.
Yes, we do have several questions queued up. The first question comes from Timothy Garr. Please go ahead.
Hi, Tim.
How you doing, David?
I'm doing well.
A couple of questions. I assume you're investing in larger companies then, since we're looking at dividend-paying companies. And if those countries that those larger companies are in is taken from the emerging markets index and goes into the developed market index, does that mean it's going to force you to take it out of the portfolio? That's number one. Number two, are you a non-diversified fund? In other words, can you take concentrated positions in your best ideas? And we'll go with those two right now. I know there were a couple of others. I'm glad you touched on the frontier market aspect.
Okay, I think there were three questions in there. Let me go in reverse order. We are a diversified fund, which for those of you that aren't familiar with this, it's a particular regulation from the 1940 Act itself, or mm-hmm. maybe it's one that the SEC has propagated. So I think it's actually law. It's about concentration of the fund, and it's basically measured like this. You measure all the positions that are in excess of 5% of the net assets of the portfolio, and you cannot have more than 25% in those 5%ers at the time you purchase them. They could appreciate to being more than that, but at the time you put incremental money into those positions, you can't put any more in once you hit the 25% cap. So you could have one 25% position, or you could have, say, two 12.5%ers or five 5%ers. I would say that as long as you satisfy that, you are a quote-unquote diversified fund. We are a diversified fund. I've always felt that level of diversification was, or that level of concentration, I should say, was very ample for my style and strategy. I don't need more than that. A big position for me is 4 to 5. It's a huge position is 4 to 5%. Mm-hmm. One thing I'm doing a little differently from my past career at my former employer in the context of CFAIR is that I am trying to let my I hate to use the word winners because I think that suggests we're doing something right. We never know if we're doing it right, but we try and let our positions run longer. If we've done good work on a stock and it's doing well, maybe we had 3% in it and it's doubled. That means it's 6%, and that's above what I just told you is a big position for me. So I'm trying to tolerate that sort of thing more so than I would have in the past, where I would usually quickly trim it back before it mm-hmm. would exceed 5%. So that's going to induce a little more volatility in the portfolio. The dividend thing, just quickly, we would not necessarily exit a position because it moved out of the emerging markets index. That's why we designed the EM ourselves via our prospectus. There's a list of countries. We particularly don't want to say quit Korea, South Korea. A lot of people have thought it might move to developed market status. Ironically, the reason it's not is exactly the reason I gave. Its capital markets are deemed not worthy yet. Even though it's a very rich and technologically advanced country, its capital markets are still iffy, and that's what MSCI is holding out against it. for its movement into the developed strata. And then the question about dividend payers, you know, it really isn't necessarily the case. You look for large stocks. You can find very, very stable dividend payers with good dividend growth, which is what we favor in mid and to some extent small company segments. I would say our biggest overweighting consistently is mid caps. I shouldn't say overweighting. That's our biggest slice of our portfolio. Our biggest overweighting is small caps because the index has almost nothing in small caps, and we define small caps as less than a billion U.S. Mm-hmm. equivalent. The index has, I think, only a percentage point or two in such companies. We've tended to have, say, 15% to 20% in such companies. So that's a huge overweighting. But in terms of the meat of our portfolio, we've had variously, I'd say, 35% to 50% in mid caps, which we judge we deem to be between 1 to 10 billion. And I think you find a lot of very steady, capable dividend payers in that group, and that's been our bread and butter, if you will.
Now, can we just touch real briefly on country allocation? I assume you're doing more of the established markets in the emerging markets. And I think David said you were a global fund, so does that mean you've got exposure in the U.S. as well?
No, we're a global emerging market fund. It's industry jargon, but what we mean is we cover all emerging markets. I think David was alluding to the fact that earlier in my career, I was an Asia-only specialist. And so the difference at Seafarer is that I have broadened my remit to look at all emerging markets.
Now, before you worked with the Matthew Fund, right?
Yes.
Right. So you're located in San Francisco, right?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay.
Great. Pedro, did you have another question, sir?
We do have another question.
Oh.
Yes.
Cool.
And the next question is from David Hubbard. Please go ahead.
Yeah, great. Hey, thanks so much. And a great presentation, Andrew. And I'm an investor in the fund, and I plan to invest quite a bit more as well. But could you just, this would be a real uncomplicated question, I think. Just could you tell us, are you investing yourself in the fund? And could you give just a brief comment, perhaps? I mean, I think it looks like a great fund to me to invest in. I have invested in it, and I plan to invest more. Can you give me a quick synopsis? Why am I wise to do so?
So I am invested in the fund, and also in the firm behind the fund. So I personally and my family are very invested in the success of the fund, I guess I would say.
Great.
Why would you be wise to do so? This is one of the things I actually struggle the most to do, because it really demands knowing your personal situation as well as sort of an asset allocation question, which is not my forte. I do think, what I would say broadly, is that I think the emerging world is emerging, contrary to the experience of the last 3 years, where I said the growth was quite anemic. I think you have to keep in mind, people who are marketing emerging market strategies love to kind of come up with themes, which I think are really the anthema of disciplined, careful investment. And some of the themes they talk about are sort of the emerging market consumer and, you know, middle class formation and this sort of thing. And this is happening. I'm not trying to dismiss this, but I think the real reason you invest in these emerging markets is because they are really sometimes in very dismal shape. And they are far less than perfect. Sometimes the horrible things you read about them are true. But what's happening is there's a drive in human nature to make sure your kids do better than you did. There's a drive to, you know, improve your living standards. That drive is incredibly powerful. I have a friend and a former colleague who he used to talk about how his family in China, his sister-in-law in China had sort of started basically, you know, and his kids grew up in a mud hut and, you know, a hut with a mud floor. And by the time they were adults, they had freestanding townhouse with a car and a lawn, and their kids were going to a private school, and they did that in the course of one lifetime. And I always tell myself, you know, if you could buy a stock that represented the gains in their living standard, that would be the single best stock you would put 100% of your money in that stock. there are no stocks that track that gain in living standards, but the progress that happened along the way, there were companies and there was a lot of improvement in their living standards, and there were companies that helped to unlock that change. They created value. Some of that value was reflected in their revenues and profits, and some of their revenues and profits was capitalized in their stocks. And so some distant fraction of that shows up in the stock market, and that's what we're here to try and do. And I do think that is a powerful enough growth driver for capital appreciation that people should pay attention to it as long as they have a long-term horizon, as long as they also understand there's currency risk involved with that equation. And if you're an American investor, it sounds like you are, you probably have dollar-based liabilities and you don't want to put too much into a foreign fund where there could be a lot of currency risk that where in the short run you could find yourself struggling to pay whatever fixed payments you have, like mortgages or college payments or whatever. So I think with part of the more speculative component of your portfolio, trying to capture some of this growth is a good thing. Trying to recognize it's all happening because it came from a low base. You know, these economies are really coming in many cases from a tough place, a less than ideal place, but they have the hunger to improve, and that's what drives the stock market ultimately.
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you, Andrew.
And in SEC terms, we'll note that you have over $1 million of your own money invested in the fund. Are you continuing to buy shares?
I don't disclose that, David. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Not a problem.
Yeah.
Pedro, do we have other questions in the queue?
We do have other questions. The next question comes from Sheldon Safir. Please go ahead.
Hi, and thank you for your presentation so far. I've actually been looking around for a proper emerging market fund for quite a few years. We do have one. I do run the family office over the last few years, and we've had one for quite a few years. We've done okay with it. We've tried another one that fellow just left the Artisan, Lewis Kaufman, and I've sort of come across your track record a couple of years ago when you started your new fund. I do appreciate, you know, the clarity you've given about, you know, how you like to approach your investments and so on and so forth, and it sounds real compelling if I want to have exposure to emerging markets. My question is, why should I want to have exposure to emerging markets? I'm sorry. What will it give me more than staying domestic? I mean, currently we have... I know David may not like this, but as a family office, we do have about 45 different funds. Typically, they're large. They're all institutional shares. We've done well. We do look to keep them for as long as possible. But looking based on track records, based on volatility, you know, if you want to use Sharpe ratios, why should I go to emerging markets?
I'll be honest with you. This is sort of similar to the just preceding question. This is the one question that, as long as I've been doing this, I can't answer it. You have to make that up, your mind up for yourself on that one. I wish I could say here are the reasons why. I'm a strong believer, and I founded my firm on the principle that the kind of growth that I just spent about 2 or 3 minutes talking about. Is real, it's meaningful, and it will create long-term capital appreciation. But beyond that, your decision to move out of the domestic and into the international is really your own. What I try and do is build a very sustainable way to harness the growth that I talked about and trying to give what I think to be the best slice of it. What you're asking is an asset allocation question, and it kind of goes beyond my pay grade. The one thing I would say, I think a lot of the returns over the last 3 years, to an extent that maybe people don't detect or understand, have been driven by currency shifts. Mm-hmm. 3 years ago, to an extent that people are shockingly, you know, forgetting about, people were extremely negative about the dollar.
Right.
And very, very excited about owning things that were, you know, proxies for non-dollar value, either commodities, gold, oil, or emerging market bonds denominated in their local currencies. We have had a huge and pronounced shift the other way, where the dollar has kind of reasserted itself as the almighty king of all currencies and, frankly, all asset classes. And that has, in turn, sort of fueled a lot of the kind of gains in domestic markets, I think. I would just say, very basically, I don't think that will go on forever. In fact, I think there are already things happening that will stop that. Now, I would caveat my remarks by saying I'm talking on a 5 to 10 year view, which may be well beyond what most people are thinking about on this call. And I don't know what will happen, by the way, when this trend stops. I have speculations, but I would just say simply, I do pretty strongly believe it will not go on forever. We've had a pendulum swing from one very far end to the other very far end, and I think the pendulum will swing back, and it will change people's perception yet again. Or a different way of putting it is the emerging markets have grown all the way through this period. The growth has been poor. It's been anemic. But it has looked bad in equity terms because currencies have stunk. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't make it a baseline assumption that currencies will always stink. What we've had is an unwinding of a massive bet against the dollar to an overwinding of a massive bet on the dollar. And that has exacerbated all of these effects as viewed from the perspective of a dollar-based investor domestically.
Great.
And I just would,
Pedro,
I would have not confuse mm-hmm. those things.
Yep. We're down to our last minute or two. I thought I would check in with Pedro to see if there was another caller or so on the line or another
yes.
question or so.
We do have more questions. The next
Why
question.
Why don't we see what we can squeeze in?
Okay. The next question comes from Dennis Green. Please go ahead.
Hi, Andrew. I'm a board member that contributes a little bit, and I've been mulling over an issue that you can probably deal with in the next minute or so. So I'll cut out the compliments and go straight to the score. You were talking about liquidity indexes and the problems that certain markets can have at unpredictable times. Particularly certain companies that you might be holding at the time, where a company can look pretty good credit-wise, and then all of a sudden the markets will turn on them and they'll have a crunch in credit and in the currency. And following that theme, let's go to Eastern Europe, non-euro currency-based countries. I was very shocked at how when the Ukrainian currency went into free fall, how much of an impact it had on non-Euro Eastern European countries. And I believe you have like 7 companies that you hold in that area. Were any of them impacted? And do you look at the quality of their debt that they have as part of your formula for picking companies in that area?
So what? We don't have any Ukrainian companies. We don't have any Russian companies. Haven't had since our launch.
Polish, I think.
We have some Polish companies and some Turkish companies, and we categorize them on our website as being Eastern European. Sort of technically, that's where they lie, but one could argue where they really sit. The Polish companies, I'm very confident about their liquidity and solvency. One is a bank. One's a utility. Has almost no debt, which is rare for a utility. Usually utilities have enormous amounts of debt. And then the last Polish company is a software company, has no debt, or has a tiny, minuscule amount of debt. Mm-hmm. The Turkish companies have a bit more debt, but not to the point where I would worry about them. But definitely the zloty, which is the Polish currency, and the lira have fallen in the last 2 years. The zloty, sort of more surprisingly, there's not, I wouldn't say anything particularly wrong with Poland's fiscal or monetary conditions. It's simply, I think, a function of the fact, I would pin it more not on Ukraine, but more on the euro. Poland is part of an accession member to the eurozone, and I think the zloty, sadly, has just corrected and fallen more or less in tandem with the euro's decline, which has been very pronounced. And so, you know, the markets are basically saying you're a cousin of the euro, and we're going to treat you as such. And it's been tough on Poland. I wouldn't say it's, you know, it's been tough on Poland generally. I wouldn't say it's been particularly acutely tough on our stocks, more so than in the average Polish company. But it hasn't been easy. But I'm not worried about it from their individual conditions. It has impacted the portfolio's returns, but I guess what I was trying to say is we're holding them for a longer horizon than the particular period we've just been through. So I'm not especially worried about that.
As you said, that when these things happen, companies can kind of change their plans. You know, after taking a couple of punches to the gut, they kind of pull back on their growth plans because they get scared. And they kind of change the way they finance the company because they want to survive.
I would like to – I guess what I would put it is we try and find the companies that have already figured that out so that they're not necessarily shell-shocked by the change and have to change the way they grow. You're suggesting we're finding higher growers that – I mean, I think what you're sort of implying very in a very basic sense is – you know, what if we found these high-growth companies, then they were shell-shocked by the change in the environment and then became low-growth companies.
Yeah.
What we try and find is companies that have already kind of been through that or have some seasoning in this regard
Depend on the debt markets for financing. And
exactly.
Okay.
Or not to an extent that would be, problematic. So they're mainly self-financing. I definitely look at companies that have debt. So I wouldn't say that they're all debt-free companies by any stretch, but they're largely independent and self-financing, and they don't have business models that would be interrupted to any great extent by these sort of events.
Okay.
That's what we're looking for.
And with that, I think we're going to have to pull our hour to a close. We know that there are still some folks in the queue, and what we'll do is share the email addresses for folks who had questions with Andrew and the folks at Seafarer in the hopes that you and they might be able to follow up and resolve some of those questions in the days ahead yet. And I'd like to thank Andrew and you all for your time tonight. A story about this call and a recording of it will be available at the Observer on May 1st. Highlights and the link to an MP3 of the call will be posted to the Observer's discussion board, to which you're all invited, within the next 48 hours. As a kind of passing note, interesting stuff continues to bubble up. For one, the clock is ticking on the offer from River Park Funds to waive the minimum initial investment requirement on David Perkowitz's new Focused Value Fund. That offer ends April 30th, and interested parties should probably reach out to River Park for details. In addition, the good folks at Grandeur Peak have placed three new funds in registration with the SEC, Global Micro, and two funds that they label stalwart that appear to be mid-cap. They'll launch in the summer, and we'll try to keep track of them for you. We're still debating the question of a May conference call. We'll give you a heads up in our May issue about whether or not we're going to go on summer break early with this particular feature. With that said, Andrew, thank you. You really do a good job of helping folks understand the way you've been thinking about the emerging markets and about your portfolio. I think that it's reassuring to me and to other folks who are invested in the fund to have a chance to listen to you, not just talk about it, but talk with folks about it and get a sense of the kind of depth of your understanding. We're grateful for it, and we thank you all for your evening.
Well, thank you very much, David. It's my pleasure.
The conference is now concluded. Thank you for attending today's presentation. You may now disconnect.